Welcome to City Arts and Lectures, a season of talks and onstage conversations with some of the most celebrated writers, artists, and thinkers of our day. This week, a conversation with Andrea Elliott, an investigative reporter for the New York Times. In 2012, Elliott set out to report about what it's like to be an unhoused child living in New York. She met 11-year-old Dasani Coates, living in a shelter with her parents and seven siblings. The conditions were unsurprisingly horrible, and the challenges faced by Dasani's family, enormous and multi-generational. Elliott followed Dasani and her family for 8 years, and her book, Invisible Child, Poverty, Survival, and Hope in an American City, weaves together Dasani's story, including her time at a boarding school designed to help disadvantaged girls escape poverty, with the history of Dasani's family, tracing the passage of their ancestors from slavery to the Great Migration North. It's the story of a fierce, resilient, and overburdened child, and the profound impacts of poverty and racism. On October 5th, 2021, Andrea Elliott talked to Isabel Duffy about the book, what it took to write it, and what she'd like readers to take from it. Join us now for a conversation with Andrea Elliott.
Andrea, welcome to City Arts and Lectures. It's such a pleasure to have you here with us today. And congratulations on a really extraordinary book. Invisible Child is such a powerful and moving read. And as someone who has worked as a therapist with teenagers, I'm so grateful to you personally for shining a light on stories that have otherwise really remained kind of unspoken or in the shadows. So I guess we should really start at the beginning, and perhaps you could introduce us to how you met Dasani and how what got you interested in the in reporting this in the first place.
Thank you for those words, Isabel. I'm delighted to be here to share with you the story of this book. This all began on a sunny day in October 2012 when I, as a reporter for the New York Times, was standing at the entrance of a homeless shelter in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. And I was there because I was trying to find my way into a really big story, which was the city's homeless crisis. And that's a big story that continues to this day. By then, there were more than 22,000 children in New York City's shelters. And this was also one of the most unequal cities in the United States and one of the richest cities in the world. So just to give you an image of how large that population of children was, these 22,000 kids would not fit in Madison Square Garden. I wanted not just to write about the homeless crisis, but specifically to write about one child and one child's experience being poor, because at that time, the United States had a child poverty rate of 1 in 5 children who were growing up below the poverty line, which made this one of the countries with the highest child poverty rates in the world. And so I was looking for a way into this in New York City, and I was standing outside this shelter in Brooklyn. And that's where I met Dasani. I'll never forget the first moment that I saw Dasani and her family. They were walking outside the shelter in single file. The mom, whose name is Chanel, was at the front of the line, as she always was, and her children were following dutifully behind her in a single file. And that image just has stayed with me ever since, because it captured so much of what this family represented. Walking this way was how you survived the street. This is what they later explained to me. And they had so much discipline, so much unity. There was such a strength in their bond. And those things were just immediately apparent. And I felt very compelled to get to know them. Dasani, of the 8 children, really stood out to me almost immediately because she wanted my attention. She was 11 years old. She's a typical New York City kid. full of sparkle and words. She wanted to talk. She had a lot of things to say. And one of the things I found so moving about her from the moment we met was her ability to articulate what she was going through with perspective. She could talk about the conditions of her life in a way that many adults would even be unable to. And I was just kind of struck like that. And the way she spoke was riveting to me because she spoke in images. And as a writer, that's something that one is drawn to, is the person who wants to describe their life, wants to help you visualize it. And one of the first quotes I wrote down was Dasani describing the room that her family was crammed into in this decrepit shelter, the Auburn Family Residence, all 10 members of them living in one room. She said it's like 10 people trying to breathe in the same room, and they only give you 5 windows. I was just constantly, my pen was just flying every time Dasani started talking. One of the first things I wrote down was Dasani like the water. That's how she introduced herself to me. And it's because she'd been named for the bottled water that had just come to Brooklyn a year before she was born. There's a lot more we can talk about, so I can stop anytime if you want to jump in with a question, but the names of her and her mother and what those names represent are a very big part, I think, of the story.
I think they're really important. I think please do explain how their names, yeah. How Dasani came to be called Dasani and her mother's name and the others.
So there is such a current of aspiration running through this family. I think like most American families, you know, one is hopeful. One wants to reach for more. Chanel was born in the late 70s. Her mother, who's a single mother at that time, was in Eastern Brooklyn, in a very different New York City than today's New York City, a very different Brooklyn than today's gentrified Brooklyn. At that time, in the 80s, when Chanel was growing up, it was rare to encounter a white person or a wealthy person in her neighborhood. Her mother, when she was pregnant with Chanel, was looking for a name, and she was flipping through a magazine and she saw an ad for the perfume Chanel, and she just liked the way it sounded. And I think she liked to imagine this better life, even though she didn't know the scent of that perfume. The scent of that perfume could only be found in a department store. You'd have to leave this predominantly poor neighborhood and travel into Manhattan and go sample that perfume. As Joni's sister Margot told me, you know, we had simpler scents in the local bodega, things like Charlie that you kind of splash on your body and you don't really think too much about. But this notion of this Chanel perfume really grabbed Joni, and she went with that name. If you fast forward to 2000, we're now in a new century. It's the 21st century. Massive changes have begun to come to Brooklyn and will continue to come over the next decade, bringing in many white homeowners who are eager to buy in Brooklyn because they can still afford a home there, whereas they couldn't in Manhattan. As all of this change is occurring, Chanel becomes pregnant with her first child. And the name that she chooses is also for a bottle that has a liquid inside it that is sold, something precious. But she's holding it in her hand. That's the difference. Whereas Chanel's name comes from this magazine and this kind of aspiration that is imagined, Chanel is actually sees Dasani, the bottle, on the shelf of the bodega. Her first thought is, who would pay for water? It just struck her as bizarre. And it certainly wasn't an indulgence that she was going to give herself. In fact, that day that I wrote down Dasani's words, my name is Dasani, like the water, I asked her, have you tasted this water? And everyone in the family shook their heads. They had not ever bought a bottle of Dasani water. Any true New Yorker is proud of New York's tap water. So I will also give them that. It's not just about being poor. they like the quality of the city's water. But to Chanel, it also symbolized this other life. That also the sound of it, Dasani, she just liked the sound of it. She then named her second daughter Aviana after Evian. This was just a tradition in the family. And I think what Chanel also intuited as she was holding this bottle of water in her hand was that this new clientele had arrived to Brooklyn, this new flock of people. And they would leave entire, you know, whole portions of Brooklyn remade. They would renovate townhouses, open up fancy coffee shops and boutiques. People would be forced to leave who couldn't afford to keep up with their rents, including artists, people of all backgrounds. But I think what wound up happening by the time I met Dasani, she's 11 years old, she's living in this shelter, is that you've got these two very different extremes living within close proximity. This upper middle class to wealthy group that is new to Brooklyn and in Fort Greene in particular, right? And this deeply poor community that is able to stay put because they're either at the shelter in Auburn or they're in public housing. And so they're guaranteed those spots, although shelter was was uncertain. That's a separate subject. But for the most part, you have this collision suddenly, or not a collision. You have, for the most part, you have this encounter between the rich and the poor. And that's what Dasani was bearing witness to and living and feeling every single day. She was waking up in a room with 9 other people in it, not counting the many mice running around and the other creatures, including her pet turtle, who she adored, mold on the walls, terrible conditions. This is a city-run shelter. And she could step outside and in less than a minute be passing the entrance of a townhouse that was worth millions of dollars. So that was a new way of growing up that her mother had not experienced. She was now experiencing.
How did you go about explaining your idea for the piece? Because initially it was a piece for the New York Times. How did you go about explaining your idea for the piece to Chanel and Dasani and the family? And then how did you get their trust?
Such an important question with a long answer, if you will.
Please.
The process of trust is a process. It is not a destination. It is not something you arrive at. It is something you're constantly tending to. This is what I believe. It's not something I take for granted. I began by showing Dasani's parents my work. And they are avid readers. I brought them the original, you know, New York Times cover stories I had done and gave them those magazines to keep. And I printed a bunch of the other things I had written. They consider themselves Muslim, even though they belong to the 5% nation, which is more of an offshoot to the Nation of Islam, but they proudly identify as Muslim. And they liked that I had devoted years of my life to writing about Islam in America. And they read everything very carefully. I told them, if you'd like to call anyone I've written about and ask them if I've been fair, I will put you on the phone with them or I'll give you their number. In retrospect, that was a little risky. But I felt it was a fair thing to offer because I was asking them to let me in. And I've done this before. I've spent months immersed in the lives of other people, and I was happy to connect Dasani's family with any of those people. They didn't seem interested in doing that. They were more interested in just asking me what I wanted to capture. And my answer was your life. I think it's important that people understand not just the horrible conditions that you're surviving, but the dignity with which you survive those conditions. So it's both things. And I think in the very beginning, I wasn't entirely focused on Dasani. I was thinking maybe I'll follow a few families with three different children as the focus. Or if I write about this family, will be several children in this family. What I will say about the reporting process is I was entering into lives marked by trauma and uncertainty. And there was so much that was overwhelming to them about their lives. And certainly to me, just as an observer, that it became a huge project to figure out how to even tell the story. And so by focusing on one child, that allowed the story to find a center. But what I would say about trust and my relationship with the family is that we started many conversations that would continue for years to come about our thoughts about anything. It was almost like I wasn't interviewing them so much as in dialogue with them. And they were very curious about my background. And the more I opened up about my personal upbringing, what kinds of influences I had in my early life, the more comfortable they felt that they were getting to know me and seeing that I was a person that they enjoyed having around some of the time, did not enjoy having around some of the time. I could be very annoying. I think ultimately the best answer I have for how I maintained my ability to stay in their lives for 8 years is as simple as this. I kept showing up. And I think that there's nothing, almost nothing, that matters more, especially in the lives of poor children, lives that are marked by uncertainty, cell phones turning off, addresses changing, schools changing, beloved teachers suddenly not being in their jobs anymore. There's almost nothing that matters more than the person who shows up. And I think that continuity allowed for some kind of feeling of she's really interested in trying to go deep, which these are some of the most interesting people I've ever met. Chanel and Supreme, they are fascinating on so many levels. And I think that they would not have been open to someone writing so deeply about their lives if they didn't think that that person also was a person who wanted to delve and really try to understand the issues beneath each of these problems. Because I look at something like homelessness, not even as a problem. I look at it as a symptom of not just other problems, but systemic racism, family histories. You have to go back generations to be able to see how all of these dots connect, especially in this family. It became so clear to me that the barriers that Dasani's ancestors faced, even after they were freed from their white enslavers and moved north, were impossible barriers to cross in order to be able to achieve the same kind of thriving middle class existence that so many white American families take for granted. They were not entirely impossible. Certainly many people were able to do this. But in Dasani's family, for I would say the majority of the descendants of her great-grandfather, June Sykes, it was a very hard road. And often it did not lead to the middle class.
I think that comes across so clearly in the book. I'm someone who reads pretty fast, and I read really slowly because every page had something on it that was a revelation to me, whether it was a statistic and about present day, or whether it was kind of deep historical information. I'm really curious to know about how you went about gathering all that information about Dasani's ancestors and her family story and the kind of historical research that you did for the book in and around Brooklyn. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, I'd love to talk about that. I would start by saying that Dasani and her family have been essential partners in the reporting of their story and in the telling of their story by narrating it to me and by helping me find more than 14,000 records. These records not just cover the family's extensive relationship with various government agencies, but also look at the family's history. I'd like to also say that I really find it important to give priority to dialogue and to quotes from the person directly. And the way that I am able to do that is by relying, I work very closely with audio and video recording devices. And over these 8 years, I have 28 hours of video. I have 132 hours of audio. I used a pen called the LiveScribe pen. It's now duct taped together. It records audio while at the same time writing. And then when you write, it timestamps the audio. So you can go back, click on that word, and it will go to the recording and play it from the pen. And this was utterly thrilling to Dasani and her siblings from the very beginning. They called it my spy pen. And they would turn it into a microphone. Dasani would pretend to be a newscaster and making a new, you know, announcements with it. It became a wonderful tool of connection, but it also became a way for me to make sure that I was capturing dialogue accurately and quotes accurately. And so those were all really important to the process of reporting. Dasani got used to me saying things like, "What were you thinking in that moment?" And usually it was very quickly after the moment had happened because I didn't want her to forget. She also kept a journal that she shared with me sometimes. And, you know, we had hundreds of interviews, of course, and a lot of time just spent walking together, being in her midst, being with her family. I think that journalists, and I'm one of them, we often talk about our work as an attempt to understand. That really is our role, is to try as best as we can to understand. And I found myself saying that so often when people asked about my book over the years, that I finally looked up the root of the word. And it actually comes from the word understanden, an old English word, which literally means to stand in the midst of. It does not mean that we have reached the ultimate truth or that we could even do that. It just means we have stood. And I think if I did anything in all of these years with Dasani, it was to stand in the midst of her life. I relied on memory, family memory, to try to unearth what happened in this family. I wanted to know about this great-grandfather who people said had gone off to fight a distant war. This was the family myth. His name was June, short for Junior. And June, all I knew about him in the very beginning was that he was a janitor mopping floors in a school in Brooklyn. And he would take his kids, Dasani's grandmother and her sister Margot, along with him on the night shift sometimes. And they would go sliding up and down these long gleaming hallways as he mopped. This was in the 60s. And Margot, Linda, others in the family alluded to these war stories that June would tell. By then, he was drinking sometimes, and as one of the sisters put it to me, we thought it was the alcohol talking. I mean, they didn't think it was real. But I was curious, and so I began, with the help of a brilliant researcher, and also, by the way, an amazing genealogist, I sought as much help as I could, started to look into the family history. reached out to Veterans Affairs. This took months, and this required Chanel, the mother's, you know, permission and help. I can't tell you how many Freedom of Information requests. I think there have been dozens, but she was instrumental in these things, and we didn't know what we were going to find. And sure enough, one day in the mail comes this thick file. June Sykes had served in World War II. At that time, the military was still segregated. He was a Buffalo soldier. He was part of this population of more than 1 million African Americans who served in that war, who was sent. He was part of the only infantry, the 92nd, to be sent to Europe to fight. He was being sent abroad to fight Nazis and fascists at a time when Jim Crow ruled America. He was part of the 370th Combat Regiment, and he was technically a mechanic, but he carried a rifle like everyone else. And he was in the first combat regiment to land in Italy in July of 1944. He survived three major battles. He liberated two Italian cities. Then he returned home in 1945 with three Bronze Service Stars. The GI Bill had recently passed. This bill is credited with fueling America's middle class, making America's middle class something significant. Okay, this bill, the GI Bill, lifted millions of white veterans up by backing mortgages so that they could buy homes, by giving them college scholarships, by providing job training, by backing loans that they could start businesses. But for Black veterans, they were still returning home despite fighting Nazis abroad to an America where banks and colleges and other institutions turned their backs to Black workers, Black college applicants, Black potential homeowners. June Sykes went north. He joined the Great Migration. He landed in Brooklyn. He was someone who had repaired military vehicles under fire. So by any standard, he was a trained mechanic. But he was coming to Brooklyn to find a new life at a time when labor unions still tended to exclude Black workers. I found eventually his wage records, actually right before I finished the book. We were in our final drafts when his wage records arrived, which was an incredible triumph because I was able to then piece together the more than 30 low-wage jobs he worked after coming to Brooklyn. This is a man who should have earned the salary of a white trained mechanic. I, with the help of Chris Weimer at the Columbia Population Research Center, looked at what he should have earned and what the average Black janitor earned in that same period of 20 years. And the gap in those two incomes came to nearly $200,000. He was not able to secure a mortgage. He was landing in Brooklyn, where banks had redlined massive portions of Brooklyn and made it impossible for people to buy homes. He was unlikely to follow his fellow white veterans into the suburbs because there were restrictive covenants preventing Black people from buying homes. So he wound up settling as a renter in the Fort Greene houses, which is at the time one of the largest, it was one of the largest public housing developments in the United States. It became the place that Dasani would refer to as the projects. He raised his family there. He did what he could to support them, cobbling together a living, pouring concrete, mopping floors. By the time his daughter Joni, Dasani's grandmother, was born, industry was starting to pull out of American cities, leaving a real glut for economically for the people who remained. And Joni wound up in the late 70s and then early 80s, struggling. She was a teenage mother. She was a single mother. She had three kids. She worked. She tried to find work. She worked at a toy factory for a time with her sister. But then came the crack epidemic, and she became addicted to crack. And so she did something that became sort of legendary in the Sykes family. She decided that she couldn't take proper care of her third child, Chanel. And so she decided to give Chanel to Chanel's biological father, who at the time was living with his common-law wife, this woman, Sherry. And Sherry was the opposite of Joni. Sherry was this church-going woman who ran a daycare center. She was someone who never touched, had even a sip of alcohol. She shunned drugs. She ran a very orderly home. She wasn't able to have children of her own. And so she was delighted to have this chance at raising Chanel. And so Dasani's mother, Chanel, spent the first decade of her life going back and forth between this stable home where she went to the local school and got toys at Christmas and had every need taken care of, clothing, and then seeing her mother on the weekends, who was still addicted to crack and was really struggling. And that those two worlds lived within Chanel, I think, from a very early age. She was so aware of these two existences. But the pull of family, of blood ties, of mother is so much stronger, especially to a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old girl, than any kind of concept like your future or this is a more stable home, the kinds of words that Chanel would hear that were in arguments that people made for why she should stay with Sherry. Those arguments fell through and she left Sherry for Joni when she was 12. And I think that that's when things really began to unravel in this sort of matriarchal line that leads to Dasani's birth, because Chanel experienced so much instability in the following years. She joined the Bloods. She had dropped out of school. After she had her second child, Dasani, followed by Aviana, she then experienced a period of stability, got married to someone who also wanted to reform his life. And I think much of the book picks up there, although I look at the history very much of the family, but what it's following in real time is Dasani's life.
I think that's a perfect segue into, let's pick up where, so the first piece you wrote for the New York Times back in 2013 had a huge outpouring of, you know, response from the public. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the impact that had on Dasani, on her life, and kind of pick up where that left off back then for her.
Yes, I think for a small moment, she felt like the city's most celebrated child. She was on the front page 5 days in a row. She would run to the kiosk every morning, the local kiosk. I gave her a bunch of the newspapers, but there was nothing like seeing it and touching it with her own hands. Forget about looking at it online. It was like, here I am on the front page of the New York Times. I'm a kid, and here I am, day after day. The incoming mayor, Bill de Blasio, held a press conference vowing to make reforms to the system. At his inauguration, Dasani got on stage with the incoming public advocate, Letitia James. She held the Bible. She had a moment of fame. People reached out, readers to the New York Times, offering donations. We forwarded all of those requests to Joshua Goldfein at Legal Aid. He's a lawyer at Legal Aid, who had found lawyers who could set up a trust for Dasani. And it still exists today. It's called the Invisible Child Trust. It is on Twitter and it's on my website. And people can donate to that trust to help Dasani and her siblings with things like college. What was surprising to me was how little changed in her life. Part of it had to do with the fact that even though some money came into this trust, not a huge amount, but certainly enough that could be an investment for the future for college, the family could not access it without losing their public assistance because it's against the rules. And so they did not want to jeopardize their ability to continue to survive on things like food stamps until they found stable work. The parents were constantly struggling to find work. And so the trust kind of became this thing that was seen as something for the future. And I think that whatever power came with being on the front page of the New York Times was eclipsed by the power of poverty in anyone's life. It's just the problems are complicated and overwhelming. So about 6 months after the series ran, and by I was still following her. I never stopped following her life. It became the book in that period. I said, I think this is a book. And her family just said, you can continue to follow us. And I was sitting in her principal's office of her middle school, Paula Holmes, talking about the fact that by the end of that year of Dasani's middle school year, she had missed 52 days of school. She was then living in a shelter in Harlem and she was commuting. Chronic absenteeism is very common among homeless children. It was Holmes's idea to have Dasani apply to the Hershey School. She didn't see that there was any other way forward for this child, in part because she carried so many responsibilities at home. She was almost a third parent much of the time, helping her siblings get dressed and fed and to school on time, helping her mother cope, helping her stepfather as well. So the idea for Dasani to go to this boarding school in rural Pennsylvania came from the principal who had been to the school, had seen it, had tried to get other students in. And so about half of this book looks at Dasani's life before this pivotal moment, and the rest follows her after she leaves. And nothing about the story, I would say, is predictable, including the way it ends. It is a story like Dasani's life that is filled with twists and turns, ups and downs. You don't see them coming half the time, but she just finds a way with whatever is thrown at her to keep moving forward. And that's been the case ever since I met her.
That's absolutely true. It reads, it reads at times like fiction, and I mean that as a story unfolding. Tell us about, I knew nothing about the Hershey School. This is a fascinating place. Of course, it's from the chocolate family. So tell us about the school and what it's like there and who goes there and how was it for Dasani to be there?
So I had never heard of the Hershey School either. When Principal Holmes started to describe it, I thought, this sounds too good to be true. She said, kids go there. They're all on a full scholarship. Everything is paid for. Everything, their clothing, their dental care, their medical care, piano classes, tutoring. It's true. The school actually covers all of these costs. Can do this because it has a huge endowment. This school was created by Milton Hershey, who is America's chocolate magnate. He started the Hershey Chocolate Company. He created the chocolate bars that were the first mass-produced chocolate bars in America. He also built a town in his own name, and he left behind the school. He had no children. He left much of his fortune to the school, which now has over $17 billion in the endowment to spend. What the school offers is year-round housing, education, and support for children in need, starting in preschool and ending after they graduate high school. But actually, even beyond high school, because if you follow the school's rules, you can leave with a pretty significant college scholarship. Children at the school, there are around 2,000, live in these homes, 12 children per home. Each home is the domain of one married couple. They're called house parents. They have to be parents themselves. They have to have no more than two children they're still caring for, and those children have to be old enough that they don't distract from the job. So they tend to be in grade school, these children that the parents the house parents' biological children tend to be in grade school or beyond. And they act as surrogate parents. They drive them to soccer games. They give them wrapped birthday presents. They check their fever in the middle of the night. When a girl begins to menstruate, that's the house mother is there to help explain what to do. It's kind of extraordinary, the wraparound services that the school provides. But those services and that whole mechanism comes with a price. It's a price that plenty of Hershey graduates have told me they feel was worth paying. The price is that you are away from your family. You can see them. You can see them on holidays, on even on weekends. You can spend summer with them if it's possible. But in so many of these cases, it isn't possible. Dasani's life at home unraveled after she left. It became really hard for her to return home in a way that was safe. Hershey didn't think it was safe for her. They wanted to keep her on track. So by leaving home and separating at age 13 from the most important people to her, she experienced an identity crisis. She felt tremendously torn between her past and her future. And ultimately, she got herself kicked out. I believe she did this intentionally. She would even say she did it intentionally. She said, I had to get back home.
And the self-sabotage is a, we can feel it. And right from the beginning, there's a sense that as she talks about, she feels that she's becoming white and her language is changing. The way she speaks is changing. Her sister, Aviana, points it out to her. This is really bothersome and discordant for Dasani. Could you speak a little bit about that? Because I think it's a really important point.
Dasani felt early on at Hershey that she shouldn't speak the way she used to speak. That it wasn't okay to say words like ain't. You had to say isn't. She got constantly corrected. The school at that time tried to handle this with a lot of attention paid to the emotional toll that such instruction carried. I will say that I think I witnessed conversations between her and various staff members. Her mentors at Hershey, the majority of them were Black. And they and others at the school would talk to her about code switching, the ability to switch between one behavioral or language code and another. And I found this really fascinating because if you think about it as they're teaching Dasani to go from saying ain't to isn't, that's one thing. And I don't believe that that is the answer, actually, personally, having witnessed what happened to Dasani. I think there needs to be a greater accommodation for difference in how people speak and what makes American culture, makes it into, and what is tolerated in popular American culture as the norm. I think there's a lot of work to be done there, but my role isn't to figure this out. It is to observe and try to explain as much as I can about what I'm seeing on the ground. And what I found so interesting about the code switch conversation was the point that one of the house parents made to Dasani, that everyone code switches all the time. Teenagers do it. They'll talk to each other one way on their phone in texts. I mean, we all know if anybody has kids, they know what I'm talking about. And they'll speak in a different way to their parents. Someone might be on the phone at the office, a lawyer, a doctor, who knows, and sound one way with clients and a completely different way when their five-year-old calls. So she even agreed with this. She said, and he knew a lot, the house parent who said this to her, about her battles at home and the tension she would often run into with her stepfather, Supreme, who she considered her father. She called him daddy. She said, you know, he said to her, with Supreme, you speak one way, and with your friend on the street, you can speak in a different way, right? You're not going to talk to Supreme the way you talked. And she said, you're absolutely right. I have these two different ways of talking. She came to see it as editing. And this was at the advice of her Black therapist, Julie, who said to her, it's not that you're going to be two-faced by doing this or that you're changing who you are. It's that you're learning to keep certain thoughts in your head. You're editing them out. I think Julie at that point was, I didn't witness those conversations because, and you're a therapist, Isabel, so you'll understand this. My mother is a therapist as well. And I felt it was very important to not intrude at all in Dasani's therapy sessions, to not be present, to not ask about it. I only began talking to her about what happened in those sessions, as well as with Julie, who didn't talk to me about the sessions, actually. I only began talking to Dasani about what happened in those sessions after she left Hershey. And I also was able to see records. And I was able to interview Julie about her life, but not about Dasani. So I think both the school and I were equally, we were on the same page that that was a sacred space and that's something that needed to be protected. And I even said to Dasani, even if you want to talk to me about what's happening in your therapy sessions, I think you shouldn't, because you need a place to vent even about me. Mm-hmm. I'm annoying. Go for it, you know? And she laughed. I think that, though, what she recalls Julie saying in that moment was about trying to say to Dasani, you can move between different worlds. It's possible. It doesn't mean you give up your core self. It means that you're adjusting to different modalities. And I think that Dasani just felt ultimately that that required too much, that required abdicating a very, very essential part of herself. I believe that when she got kicked out of Hershey and returned to New York, she was, in a sense, repatriating herself to her family and to her city. And to this day, I think she's just been happier ever since she got back, even though there have been many ups and downs in her family. She seems more at peace being home, being near her siblings and her mother, and everyone else, than being not only far away, but in this other world, far away.
I think that you really capture that that kind of the leap she takes when she's asked to leave Hershey and return to New York. You really feel there is a very real danger for her. And although she's going home, what does home mean? And you know, the streets of New York are not a safe place, it turns out, for Dasani. after leaving Hershey. I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about what it was like to witness that.
I'm so glad that you just said, what does home mean? I think this is going to the heart of this whole book. At the very beginning of this project, when I was just writing the story for the Times before it became a book, in my mind, I was writing about a homeless girl. That was the label that was attached to her problem, her current problem. I have come to see that word very differently. It's an important word because it describes the condition that so many Americans are confronted with by virtue of a lack of affordable housing, by virtue of all kinds of problems, including the pandemic. There are more than a million American school children who have experienced homelessness over the last year. But I also think it's problematic sometimes how people think of the word homeless, because it suggests a person adrift, a person who is transient, a person who has no roots. And I am hard-pressed to think of another New Yorker I know with deeper roots in Fort Greene, right in the very neighborhood where Dasani was living in as a random assignment to a homeless shelter, than Dasani. She went back four generations in that very neighborhood. I remember asking her, what is home to you, Dasani? This was as she was really struggling, about to leave Hershey. And she said to me, home is the people I hang out with, the people I grew up with. That, to be honest, is really home. Family who have had my back since day one. It doesn't have to be a roof over my head. At Hershey, I feel like a stranger, like I don't really belong. In New York, I feel proud. I feel good. I feel accepted when I'm in New York. So this is a child who, now she's 20, wants to feel at home wherever she goes. And that means having the freedom to speak like her sisters without hearing this other voice in her head correcting her. It means being able to celebrate her favorite music, the way she wants to dress, and at the same time, going to college, which she's now doing. She became the first person in her family to graduate from high school, in her immediate family. And she's now become the first to start community college. She's at LaGuardia Community College. She wants to major in business. She wants success. She wants to escape poverty without having to escape home, which is her family, which is the streets she knows best. And I think that that is such an essential lesson that I learned in writing this book, and that I hope comes through in reading it.
It really does. It I think coming back to the, you know, the beginning of our conversation, where you describe Chanel walking almost like with a kind of parade of ducklings behind her, that solidarity that's unshakable. And despite the, you know, incredible challenges the family's faced, there is a you know, extraordinary resilience. I just wanted to ask you about the, just to rewind a tiny, tiny bit back to 2019. What was it like to see her graduate? Were you there when she walked the stage of high school graduation?
We were on FaceTime. I was not able. That was actually one of the few things I was not able to be there for. I was dealing with family stuff, and we celebrated together. But, you know, she was just over the moon. She was beaming, and she just felt, Dasani was floating for weeks after that. It lifted her. It was her proudest moment, I would say, ever.
So tell us, what do you hope readers will take away from Invisible Child?
So the main thing that I hope people will take away is a different view of what matters in the story of child poverty. We tend to celebrate the one kid who got out. This happens in movies, it happens in fiction, it happens in popular culture. This escape from poverty narrative is such a part of the American narrative, in a sense, that if you work, this is a land of limitless opportunity. If you work hard enough, nothing will stand in your way. And I think those stories are incredibly inspiring and deserve to be known. But for every child who does manage to make it out, there are so many more who are just as capable, just as willing, just as talented, and who simply can't because of the tremendous burdens that are not of their own making. I think once we start to grapple with the reason why so many don't make it out, we are forced to reckon with those conditions versus taking joy out of the notion that if you, versus taking hope out of the notion that if you work hard enough, you can make it out. That lets us all off the hook in a sense. I think that Invisible Child turns that traditional narrative on its head. I think her story is just as worthy, it's just as riveting, but it's far more complicated, and I would argue way more representative of what happens to poor children. I think another important takeaway is that I hope this book gets readers to start to think beyond labels like poor, like homeless, which really only describe a current plight. They lack this deep historical context that I've tried to explore in this book. You can't look at Dasani's poverty without looking at its racial underpinnings, from slavery to Jim Crow South to redlining in Brooklyn. Race defines this family's link to government systems like child protection and criminal justice, housing, public education, health, even employment. All of those things are interconnected. And I think that's the biggest takeaway of all, is that the material reality of Dasani's life, her homelessness, her lack of money, is not the story. It's merely an invitation to learn the story. It's merely the point of departure.
That seems like the perfect place to end our conversation. Andrea, it has been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much. And will you please also pass on our very best and huge gratitude to Dasani and her family for sharing their story so openly with everybody?
Yes, I will.
It's a very important book, and thank you so much for sharing it with City Arts and Lectures.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Andrea Elliott in conversation with Isabel Duffy. This program was recorded on October 5th, 2021. These broadcasts are produced by City Arts and Lectures in association with KQED Public Radio, San Francisco. Executive producers are Kate Goldstein-Breyer and Holly Mulder-Wallen. Director of Communications and Design is Alexandra Washkin. Juliet Gelfman-Randazzo is Associate Director of Communications and Digital Media. The Post-Production Director is Nina Thorson. The Sydney Goldstein Theater Director, Stephen Eckard. The Recording Engineer is Jim Bennett. Theme music composed and performed by Pat Gleason. The founding producer is Sydney Goldstein. City Arts and Lectures programs are supported by grants for the arts of the San Francisco Hotel Tax Fund. Additional funding provided by the Wallace Alexander Gerbode Foundation, the Mimi and Peter Haas Fund, the Bernard Osher Foundation, and the Friends of City Arts and Lectures. Support for recording and post-production of City Arts and Lectures is provided by Robert Mailer Anderson and Nicola Miner. To attend a live program, see who's coming next, or find out more about our podcast, visit our website at cityarts.net. That's cityarts.net.